So hello, great to be standing here again. So I'm Devon, and this is going to be the first of a series of four evenings on the on studying discourses from the Pali Canon. So already, for those of you who are perhaps newer to Buddhism, you've got these code words, Pali Canon, suttas, discourses, and the whole point of what I'll be doing over the next 4 weeks is to make it quite clear what we're talking about. It's not so difficult, but there's some things to know. And I'm going to do that by introducing you week by week to four short discourses of the Buddha. Tonight, the discourse to the Kalamas. You'll find out who they are, what this is about. Next week, discourse of the turning of the wheel of Dharma, the Buddha's first discourse, so it said. The week after that, the discourse on the not-self characteristic. Terrible titles, aren't they? They sound a bit better in Pali, but anyway, all will become revealed week by week. And then the fourth week, a very interesting discourse called the discourse on how everything is on fire. So I've chosen these four discourses because we can go through each of them in an hour together and get to grips with them. Does that make sense? Rather than there being large amounts of discourse which we don't quite understand. But before we get on to the discourse to the Kalamas, let me say a bit about the point of such study. So I was thinking about this, and what came to mind as being perhaps the first thing to say is that, well, really, Buddhism is a living tradition of spiritual practice. If it isn't that, what's the point? By living tradition, what I mean is that those of us who've become Buddhists, who've perhaps become ordained into the Triratna Buddhist order, do so because we've learned the Dharma as it's lived from other people, from teachers, those who've been practicing the Dharma for longer than ourselves. It's passed on directly in that sense. This is particularly obvious when we go on retreat and we get to learn the details. It's not so much the details, how to work in meditation, which is often very personal, if you see what I mean. It's so much of practicing Buddhism is about friendship. Friendship and communication. So with that in mind, when I turn to study, the question is not so much, these are the discourses of the Buddha, that's why they're important. It's rather the other way around. How can these really old discourses attributed to the Buddha help us in our living tradition? And that's the approach I'm going to take. So it's not scholarly in a way. Does that make sense? The scholarly question of what does this word mean? Or how come the Buddha said this here and that there? You know, that's not really what we'll be talking about. But even if we look at the discourses in this living way, there's still a couple of dangers. On the one hand, we could think, oh, if this is what the Buddha taught, then this is what we should believe. What Buddhists should believe. In fact, all Buddhists should believe this, because look, this is what the Buddha taught. So there's, on the one hand, there's a sort of literalism that is a possibility if one looks at these early Buddhist discourses. Literalism, as in taking them literally. And that can lead to an attitude of fundamentalism. Buddhist fundamentalism is totally benign, by the way. It means being fundamentalist about Buddhist scriptures. The Buddha wasn't vegetarian or something, but he definitely didn't. He had some recommendations about when you should accept meat in your begging bowl. An example might be that there's a kind of tendency that Buddhist teachers these days can get into of appealing to Buddhist scriptures to ask, well, what did the Buddha originally mean? What was this authentic teaching of the Buddha? Which is, of course, very fascinating. Wouldn't it be great to know what the Buddha really said? But it turns out that what he really said depends on which of these people you read. They end up deciding that the Buddha said rather different things. He perhaps didn't teach rebirth at all. Or perhaps he definitely taught rebirth. Now, there are two very different options, but which it's difficult to know exactly, to be a really literalist Buddhist, actually, in that sense. And the other danger, apart from literalism, is supposing that, well, because these are very old discourses and, well, we're a living spiritual tradition, well, we don't need to bother with them at all. We could just leave all those aside as very old stuff. Perhaps other Buddhists might be interested in them. But we've got our teacher, Sangharakshita, and he's passed on Buddhism to us. Well, you can see the danger with that one, perhaps. It could very easily just lead us into a kind of cult-like approach to what we take the Dharma to be. So I think there's a sort of middle way we can take in reading these early discourses in between literalism and sort of not taking them seriously, which is of taking the early discourses of the Buddha as literary documents attributed to the Buddha. These discourses have been passed down as the teaching of the Buddha. We can relate to them in that way, but in the way that we relate to literature. Great literature informs us. It comes alive in our imaginations and elevates, as it were, our understanding. And given that this particular kind of literature is attributed to the Buddha, that can be a kind of resource for when we want to know, well, what is the Dharma? What is Buddhism? What perhaps is a point of view on this particular topic? Well, we can consult this body of literature. And just as you might ask for George Eliot's view on justice or women, so on, one can ask, one can inquire with the Pali discourses about the meaning of meditation, let's say. Without supposing that's the only resource we've got. So I'm proposing that we look at some short discourses as literature. So maybe this is the time to pass around the discourse to the Kalamas, a kind of handout. I did. As Kemi Jyoti says, there's 30 hands there, and I think there's 32 of us. Maybe as a going around, I'll just say something a little bit more about this word Pali canon, this phrase Pali canon, because you'll keep on hearing it, and it really deserves a bit of an explanation. So our best understanding of early Buddhist literature is that the Buddha lived and taught in ancient India in the 5th century, before the Common Era. Wandered around for 45 years teaching. The Buddha could neither read nor write. He lived in a purely oral culture. But after the Buddha died, his followers gathered together and they pooled what they remembered of the Buddha's teaching. They got together and tried to assemble a body of teachings that they had heard from their teacher. And then over a period of 400 years, they passed these teachings on orally. So they committed them to memory, and some monks took on the job of remembering a whole chunk of these teachings and passing them on to the next group of monks and nuns. For 400 years, before they eventually were written down, around the turn of the Common Era in Sri Lanka. Since when, of course, they've been written down, and then there's a whole scribal tradition. It turns out that passing on literature orally is incredibly accurate. You can imagine a body of people sort of comparing. Have you got it right? Have you got that particular syllable right? And it's sort of self-correcting. But on the other hand, these monks and nuns who memorised the early Buddhist teachings, to make it easier for them to do that, the teachings were put into forms which made it easy to memorise. Does that make sense? And easy to memorise forms are very repetitive. And anyone who takes a look at early Buddhist texts will think, blimey, it's really repetitive. Over and over again. It's quite, from my point of view, it's kind of a bit bamboozling sometimes to read early Buddhist discourses, because they just consist of apparent repetitions with changes. It's an acquired taste, though. After you get into it, you end up really noticing the differences, what's being said. So there's a warning. Now, when I say, you still might wonder, well, what do we mean by the Pali Canon? Well, all this lot of remembered discourses, they were remembered in different parts of India and in slightly different languages in the end. And so, depending on which part of the country they went to. And one tradition of memorising these discourses was in the Pali language, which is an ancient Indian language, a bit like Sanskrit. And that went to Sri Lanka, and it was preserved in Sri Lanka and then Thailand and Burma, these other now Theravadin countries. And that's the form in which the early Buddhist discourses have been preserved, given that Buddhism died out in India in the 12th century. All those other versions of the early Buddhist discourses disappeared without a trace. That is really humbling for Buddhists to think about. Buddhism disappeared in India, so whereas Hinduism carried on. So making sense of that is really hard. Anyway, so when we say the Pali Canon, we mean the body of teachings attributed to the Buddha preserved in the Pali language. Actually, they happen to be preserved also in Chinese translation of other Indian languages. But then that's a translated version, if that makes sense. So it's a bit more remote from the original. But to give you a sense, somebody's very kindly put all these books, was it Vimalavadri, on the shrine. Maybe the Buddha, you know. Turned up. Anyway, they've put 13 volumes of discourses on the shrine here to give us an indication of what we mean by the Pali Canon. So these are translations from the Pali Canon of just some of the early Buddhist discourses. I think we could double that if we wanted the whole body of the Pali Canon. So there's a lot of it, that's what I'm saying. And some of the discourses are quite long. They're called the long discourses. Some are called the middle-length discourses. And then there's some various miscellaneous collections. There's several thousand different discourses, all sort of separate as it were, presented as separate literary units. So I'm giving you a sense of the size of it. So hence the approach I'm going to take of looking at just one of these discourses, which will give us a way into understanding this body of literature. So what I'm going to do is read through what's on your handout so that you get the overview. And then, having read it through, we can go through it a bit more slowly. You might have points or questions, and that we'll be able to discuss them. And I've got some points of clarification, ways to understand this ancient Indian discourse, which might help us relate to it. Oh, of course, yeah. Better. So you can see, if you can see the handout, that some sections are in italics. Now, these are me shortening it, because otherwise we would be here all night. So even this short discourse, I've shortened. So the discourse to the Kalamas. The Buddha was travelling with a party of monks in the part of India called Kosala when he came to a market town of the Kalamas called Kesaputta. The Kalamas heard that the Buddha was in town and came to talk to him about their problem. Lord, certain ascetics and Brahmins come to Kesaputta. They explain and clarify their own theories, but lambast, criticise and repudiate those of others, taking them apart. And then, Lord, some more ascetics and Brahmins come to Kesaputta, and they also explain and clarify their own theories, but lambast, criticise and repudiate those of others, taking them apart. So, Lord, they only leave us doubtful and uncertain. Who, we wonder, of these venerable ascetics and Brahmins is telling the truth, and who is lying? The Buddha replies, no wonder you're uncertain, Kalamas. No wonder you're doubtful. Being uncertain, doubt has arisen for you. But, Kalamas, you should not go by oral, by inherited traditions, by opinions, or by the authority of scripture, or by reason, by inference, by analogy, by metaphysical speculation, or by someone's apparent competence, or because you regard an ascetic as your teacher. Kalamas, when you yourselves know that something is unwholesome, culpable, and criticised by the wise, that something, when taken up and carried through, leads to harm and pain, then, Kalamas, you should give it up. What do you think, Kalamas? When compulsion arises in someone, does that bring well-being or harm? Harm, Lord. And a compulsive person, Kalamas, overpowered by compulsion, their mind overcome, harms living beings and takes the not given, misbehaves sexually, speaks falsely, and encourages others to do the same. Isn't all this for their long-term harm and pain? Yes, Lord. What do you think, Kalamas? When hate arises in someone, does that bring well-being or harm? Harm, Lord. And a hateful person, Kalamas, overpowered by hate, their mind overcome, harms living beings and takes the not given, misbehaves sexually, speaks falsely and encourages others to do the same. Isn't all this for their long-term harm and pain? Yes, Lord. What do you think, Kalamas? When confusion arises in someone, does that bring well-being or harm? Harm, Lord. And a confused person, Kalamas, overpowered by confusion, their mind overcome, harms living beings and takes the not given, misbehaves sexually, speaks falsely and encourages others to do the same. Isn't all this for their long-term harm and pain? Yes, Lord. What do you think, Kalamas? Are these things wholesome or unwholesome? Unwholesome, Lord. Culpable or blameless? Culpable, Lord. Criticised by the wise or praised? Criticised, Lord. When taken up and carried through, do they lead to harm and pain or not? How does it seem to you? Lord, when taken up and carried through, they lead to harm and pain, or so it seems to us. Now the Buddha asks exactly the same questions in reference to what is wholesome, blameless, and praised by the wise. When contentment, love, and wisdom arise in people, this brings well-being, since the mind is not overwhelmed by compulsion, hate, and confusion, and people do not act unethically. The Buddha goes on to recommend the practice of metta, or loving kindness. Now, Kalamas, someone who is a follower of the Noble Ones, who is without covetousness, aversion, or bewilderment, mindful and aware, lives pervading the first direction with an attitude of kindness, or metta, then the second, the third, and the fourth. One lives totally pervading the whole world, above, below, around, and everywhere, with an extravagant, magnificent, boundless attitude of kindness, without hostility and without ill will. He also recommends pervading the world with compassion, gladness, and equanimity, qualities known, together with loving kindness, as the Brahma Viharas, or divine abidings. And the Buddha goes on to give four reassurances to the Kalamas about what will happen to them. Now, Kalamas, someone who is a follower of the Noble Ones, whose attitude is thus without hostility and ill will, thus stainless and pure, finds reassurance in four ways in this very life. If there is a world beyond, if there are the results and fruits of actions rightly and wrongly done, then, on this basis, I will reappear after the breakup of the body, after death, in a good place, a heavenly world. This is the first reassurance. If there is no world beyond, if there aren't any results or fruits of actions rightly and wrongly done, then in this very life I am looking after myself, being without hostility or ill will, undisturbed and happy. This is the second reassurance. If evil that is done by someone, if evil is something that is done by someone, then I have not wished evil on anyone, and not being someone who has done evil, how will suffering touch me? This is the third reassurance. If evil is not something that is done by someone, then I can still regard myself pure in both ways. This is the fourth assurance, reassurance. So, Kalamas, someone who is a follower of the Noble Ones, whose attitude is thus without hostility and ill will, thus stainless and pure, finds reassurance in four ways in this very life. And then the Kalamas reply, this is so, Blessed One, this is so. Lord, someone who is a follower of the Noble Ones, whose attitude is thus, without hostility and ill will, thus stainless and pure, finds reassurance in these four ways in this very life. So they go on to repeat exactly what the Buddha had said. But then they conclude, wonderful, Lord, wonderful. It's as if someone were to set upright something overturned, or explain something that was obscure, or show the way to someone lost, or carry a lamp into the darkness so that those with eyes can see. In the same way, Venerable Gotama has made the Dharma known in many ways. We go for refuge to the Blessed One, to the Dharma, and to the Sangha of monks. May the Venerable Gotama remember us as lay followers who have gone for refuge from this day onward for as long as life lasts. So I've given you this kind of summary of the Kalama Suttas. It's not really a summary, is it? It's like a condensed version, that's the way to put it, isn't it? To make it perhaps something that I could read out in 5 minutes, like I did. Without really losing very much, I've just taken out quite a few of the repetitions, condensed them down a bit. And perhaps it was evident as I read it out that, well, you could kind of get most of it, but there's quite a few, there's quite a bit which needs a bit of explaining, and it's all set in a very different world. And this is, of course, why we need to treat it as literature and not be too literal, because it's all set in ancient India, which is, of course, where the Buddha lived. And there's a reminder here, I think, of just, in a way, India, however many thousands of miles away it is, 2,500 years ago, is culturally quite remote from us, if that makes sense. Not only are we as Westerners inheritors of a European cultural tradition, but 2,500 years is a long time in terms of the development of culture. The Buddha was teaching around the same time as Socrates in Greece, and understanding Socrates' philosophy is quite a task. So even if we really value the early Buddhist discourses, there's a need to find our way into a different thought world. That's the way to put it, isn't it? A world of thought. And it's a leap of imagination, which of course is partly why it's so interesting to do that. We step out of our familiar thought world of 21st century Britain into ancient India. So maybe I'll just start giving you a bit of a commentary, but please interrupt if any questions arise. Any questions before I even start that?
I have a question.
Great.
The Buddha mentioned scripture, but that tends to imply some. No, scripture, the word scripture, tends to imply something written down. But I'm assuming he didn't mean something written down. So what did he mean by scripture?
When does he mention... Does he mention scripture here?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. In the authority of scripture.
Yeah.
Yes, you're right. Gosh, Taranita, this is great. So a really important point about reading Pali discourses is that usually you'd be reading them in translation, and the translators made certain choices which then influence how you understand what's going on. So Taranita's noticed that I've chosen to translate a word, Pitaka Sampadana, as authority of scripture, where Pitaka really means a basket. Yeah?
Yeah.
A basket in which we assume maybe were collected bamboo. Pardon?
Papyrus.
Yeah, palm leaf manuscripts at that time. But now thinking about it, hang on, but there weren't any at that time. So it's one of those questions that actually is quite hard to answer. And so we don't quite know what is meant by scripture by Pitaka in this place. So I've put by the authority of scripture to give us an indication of what it seems to mean. Though exactly as you say, it was an oral culture.
Do you think there might have been some kind of reference to the Vedic Brahmanic tradition in the background? Because they were definitely scriptures, weren't they?
Well, no, that the Vedic tradition was oral at that time.
Was it?
Yes, the Brahmins were passing on the Vedas with tremendous accuracy as an oral tradition.
Right.
Not writing it down. They didn't want to write it down.
Right.
Maybe it's like laws.
laws of the land.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe we won't get too... we'll get onto that little point, but Taranita's point has already just thrown up the many difficulties that come in translating this material. Shall I launch in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so the Buddha was travelling with a party of monks. So the Buddha wandered around. This is absolutely central to the sort of literary background of all the discourses. The Buddha wandered around northern India as a spiritual teacher, as many other spiritual teachers did at that time. It's, as it were, the culture, the religious culture of that day. These spiritual teachers, like the Buddha, maybe spent a few days here, a few days there. And people were keen to meet them and would support them for a time, would offer them alms, shelter, whatever they needed in return for some teachings. And he came to a market town of the Kalamas called Kesaputta. Now, a market town, that's a nice translation. It gives a sense of a small town, yeah? Imagine a small town in Somerset in the 1950s or something. We don't meet the Kalamas anywhere else in the literature of the Pali Canon. This is the only place we meet them. Bit of a pity, isn't it? They sound like a really interesting community. So there's not many of them. So perhaps they're a clan or gotra, a group of people with perhaps their own traditions who live in this particular small town. And, my own way of understanding the Kalamas is they've got a sort of small town attitude. Does that make sense? They're kind of like country bumpkins. Here, Buddha, we got this problem. But nevertheless, they're very sincere. As I'm making fun of them, but they're very sincere. They come across as completely sincere. Yeah. But what I mean is that they're not part of a broader cultural movement. They don't appear to be influenced by Brahmanical culture, the culture of the Vedas, the culture of the priestly Brahmins, who, with their rituals and particular beliefs, they seem to be independent. So there's a sort of cultural diversity in northern India at that time. But nevertheless, it appears that other spiritual teachers have rolled up in Kesaputta, have set up shop, as it were. The Kalamas have gone out, perhaps given them alms, and expected some teachings. And these other spiritual teachers have, according to the Kalamas, they've explained and clarified their own views, but in doing so have criticised all the others. And it sounds like, over time, this has led to a situation where the Kalamas can't any more trust the opinions of these teachers as they come along. They just contradict each other. So in the days before the internet, in the days before newspapers or even books, all they had to go on was these so-called experts who'd roll up and give their teachings. And they didn't have even a local library. I mean, this is Buddhist literature. So the fact that they relate to the Buddha in a slightly different way and asked him to solve their problems is because this is Buddhist literature, and the Buddha is always the hero, as it were. So the Buddha's actually going to solve their problems. He's not going to give them yet another theory. You can always take that for granted in Buddhist literature. But nevertheless, they're quite upfront, aren't they? They explain the problem they're having. And perhaps it's one that wouldn't exactly occur to us or appear for us because we've got a lot of information going on. But it seems to me that, we hear the teachings of various gurus, perhaps about diet or exercise or lifestyle or enlightenment. In fact, they have a platform on the internet, don't they? And they share their points of view, their theories. I think in this day and age, they tend not to criticise each other so much. Would that be true? A bit of criticism goes on. But, you know, it's very, religious tolerance is very important in modern Western culture, isn't it? It's since the Reformation, it's been very important we don't kill each other over religion. And it's been quite successful. In fact, it's a mark of civilisation, isn't it, that we put up with each other. We share very different beliefs than we live together. So that's the reason why people don't criticise each other so much, perhaps. That's just my thought. But nevertheless, under the surface, you could imagine, can't you? Teacher X of enlightenment, when he's offline, might be saying, "Oh, this other geezer, what an idiot! What he teaches is never going to work." So we live in a sort of spiritual marketplace. Where we too have to decide, so what are we going to believe? If we're interested in something like spiritual enlightenment, well, whose view are we going to accept? How are we going to test it? How do we know? So maybe our situation is not like the Kalamas, but there's an element in which we can relate to their predicament. So here's the key thing about this sutta, that this discourse, sutta means discourse. The Buddha gives them this extraordinary teaching. You should not go, we can divide these 10 things you shouldn't go by into 3 groups. So you shouldn't go by oral or inherited traditions, by opinions, or by the authority of scripture, whatever that means in this context. So he says, you shouldn't go by those 4. Now, it seems to me that these are 4 like religious reasons for believing somebody. Perhaps that they say that their teaching is being passed on to them by an enlightened master, and that's the reason you should listen to it. Or perhaps it's the authentic teaching of Dzogchen, you know, passed on by those Himalayan masters. Or by opinions. It's more difficult to suppose that you'd be taken in by opinions, but perhaps in a more lower level way, we take account of what we hear on the street. Oh, I hear meditation's not very good for you, or something. Or, this is the important one, by the authority of scripture, if that's what it means. People really love to appeal to scripture because it appears to give a definite sort of ground of authority. The Buddha said this. I mean, the Reformation was fought over the interpretation of scripture, wasn't it? That's part of it anyway. Who was in a position to interpret the meaning of the Gospels? But the Buddha says, don't go by those 4. Don't go by religious reasons. Straightforward. Secondly, don't go by reason, by inference, by analogy, or by metaphysical speculation. So you could say these are 4 philosophical ways in which we might take someone seriously. Because they make sense. That could be reason, couldn't it? The Buddha says don't do that. But inference, you know, maybe we infer from their teaching that they sound like they know what they're talking about. Or by analogy, perhaps they sound similar to somebody that previously we thought was a good teacher. Or by metaphysical speculation, perhaps what they say kind of appeals to us because we too believe in the existence of UFOs. Bit of an extreme example, isn't it? perhaps a particular interpretation of rebirth, let's say, more down to earth. But the Buddha says, don't go by those reasons. And then finally, don't go by someone's apparent competence or because you regard an ascetic as your teacher. The word ascetic here translates the word samana, and it's a word belonging to the cultural context of ancient India. It means somebody devoted to this wandering spiritual life who practices renunciation and through that has gained some kind of insight into the nature of reality. So ascetic here, it means a bit like a teacher, but of a particular sort, if that makes sense. So the Buddha says, well, don't go by the fact that someone appears to be a completely competent person. Even don't go because, you know, say that someone not only seems competent, but you've accepted them as your teacher. Yeah. Don't go by that. Anything left?
Pretty radical.
Yeah, so don't trust anything. I can't see that that's any other way to take this teaching. So if you're looking for the truth, you can imagine the Kalamas must have been scratching their heads at this point. Just don't go by any of these usual ways in which we trust people or teachings. And what's left? And then the Buddha tells us. Basically, he sort of turns around the whole question here at this point. He says, Kalamas, when you yourselves know that something is unwholesome, culpable and criticised by the wise, that something when taken up and carried through leads to harm and pain, then Kalamas, you should give it up. I think you might be noticing, at least at a certain level, that the Buddha seems to have changed the subject here, doesn't he? Does that make sense? He's not really anymore telling the Kalamas how they can trust religious teachings. He's more sort of shifting the ground to ask, well, how can you know what's good for you? I think this is really an important shift. The Buddha isn't really in the business of telling people what to think. The Buddha's teaching is actually usually completely practical. It's about what you need to do to put it in Buddhist language, reduce ignorance and craving and come closer to true well-being. That's to put it in sort of Buddhist language. Does that make sense? So the Buddha sort of, it's implied that he knows really, he's got some sense of what would be good for the Kalamas, but he really wants them to work it out for themselves. And this kind of, what happens next, this kind of dialogue, is very reminiscent of actually Socratic dialogue, if anyone's read much Plato, who records the teachings of Socrates, his own teacher. Socrates didn't ever claim to have anything to teach. Rather, he got into conversation with people and drew out through conversation a thread of understanding between them. Although in this case, the Buddha usually gets people to a slightly more positive conclusion. So the Buddha recommends that the Kalamas look to their own experience to judge what leads to the unwholesome. And what leads to the wholesome. Which, of course, is a massive topic, isn't it? But he invites them into a way of thinking about it. So he uses a set of distinctions which get very familiar from other discourses in the Pali Canon, in which the kinds of mental states which lead to harm and suffering we could call compulsion or greed, hate and confusion. So these mental states are emotional and, you could say, intellectual or cognitive states of greed or compulsion, which is wanting stuff, hate or aversion, backing away from experience, and confusion about what to do. So the Buddha uses this sort of rough and ready threefold way of thinking about unwholesome mental states to then get the Kalamas to think through, well, what happens when you get into these mental states? What happens when you get overpowered by compulsion or hate or confusion? And you might notice that he asked them to consider, do people harm living beings, take the not given, misbehave sexually, and speak falsely, or encourage others to do the same? So these are like ways of talking about the actions that we said we were going to abstain from in the first four precepts. So the first four precepts are we undertake the precept of abstaining from harming living beings, taking the not given, sexual misconduct, and speaking falsely. So the Buddha is suggesting to the Kalamas that these mental states, compulsion, hatred, and confusion, lead people, I suppose not definitely, but possibly, to act in ways which are not wholesome. And, of course, we can reflect on that in our own experience, and probably agree with the Buddha's line of thinking. But he goes on to ask, are these things, compulsion, hatred, and confusion, are they culpable or blameless? And gets the Kalamas to say, oh, they're culpable. And then criticised by the wise or praised. And the Kalamas say, oh, they're criticised. And so he gets the Kalamas not only to look at their own experience, but to kind of appeal to their sense of conscience. And thirdly, their kind of communal sense of what would a wise person do. I mention this because otherwise, if you don't stress this, it can look like the Buddha's throwing you back on your individual judgment. And that might work quite often, but sometimes, especially if we're confused, it can be quite difficult to know exactly how to act. And the opinion of the wise, as in our friends, can be of great use and benefit at that moment. The word that we translate as the wise is vinyu here, vinyu. And it doesn't really mean those who are particularly awakened. They're not especially wise. Does that make sense? They're simply those who've got some maturity. The kind of elders of the community, you could say. So it's the wise here means those whose judgment you trust. So the Buddha answers the Kalama's dilemma, their question of who to believe, by giving a completely different way of thinking about how to judge what's going to be a benefit for them. Who knows really if that means that they know what truth teachings to trust anymore, but they now have a set of ideas about what they can trust in their own experience when they're asking about, well, how shall I live? And then typically of the Buddha, he doesn't just leave it there, but he gives them something to practice. So not only might the Kalamas now have a way to think about what's good for them, but he gives them something to do. So he recommends to the Kalamas the practice of metta, or loving kindness, which I think you've all had some experience of now through courses and classes here at the Buddhist Centre. And what we practice as metta bhavana here at the Buddhist Centre is pretty much exactly what the Buddha was teaching here. except we do it in a five-stage way, which is slightly more user-friendly than the way the Buddha taught it. The Buddha puts it here, as you can see. Just remove covetousness, aversion and bewilderment from your mind and pervade the directions with loving kindness. So it's like he's giving us the sort of ideal goal of metta bhavana, you could say. And the point being, if one can pervade the directions with an attitude of love, it's going to be quite difficult to allow mental states of compulsion or hate or confusion to overwhelm you in the way that will lead to harm. So it's a practical teaching. That isn't to say, of course, that it's an easy one, but it's something that is possible to work with. Right, I'm going to wrap this up relatively quickly. In the last section, the Buddha gives four reassurances to the Kalamas about what will happen to them next. And here we return, I think, to the kind of cultural context of ancient India, that people at that time, I suppose, like, I don't know, I mean, probably a lot of people even now, will worry about what is going to happen after death. And of course, this was the starting point of the Kalama's worry, wasn't it? Who can we trust to give us the right kinds of teachings about this important business? And once again, the Buddha gives a set of answers which are a bit unexpected. So in the terms of ancient Indian belief, if there is rebirth, then if your mental states are wholesome, full of contentment, love and wisdom, then if rebirth is true, you'll enjoy a positive one. Second reassurance, if there isn't any rebirth, because after all, who knows, it's going to depend on a set of teachings and beliefs, it's still worth acting well in just the same way, because you can be confident that you're looking after yourself in this world. And then thirdly, if there is karma, if there is the kind of action that is good and bad, which will have consequences, then you'll know that you haven't, he says, wished evil on anyone. You haven't particularly done anything which will have a negative consequence. If all that stuff about karma is equally unknowable or untrue, it's still worth living well in this way. Because one can still regard oneself as pure. He says in both ways, and I'm not entirely sure what that means. So in this way, the Buddha completely puts aside, allows the Kalamas to not worry about some questions of religious belief, and yet have every reason to look at their mental states, think about the consequences of certain mental states, practice forms of the precepts, and engage with the practice of metta. The Kalamas are really thoroughly pleased about this, you can tell. The final section, they say, "Wonderful Lord, wonderful." It's as if someone were to set upright something overturned, or explain something that was obscure, or show the way to someone lost, or carry a lamp into the darkness, so that those with eyes can see. So this is we find this formula, it repeats over and over again in the early Buddhist discourses. It's a formula by which people They convert to Buddhism, basically. It's a kind of conversion formula. So again, this is Buddhist literature. Yeah. So there's very almost every discourse ends with a happy ending, in which the people who've heard the teaching of the Buddha are very pleased. They take it to heart, and they become, they become followers of the Buddha. In this case, lay followers of the Buddha. But you know, it's not so difficult to pick up exactly why the Kalamas were quite pleased on this occasion. So, like I said, we don't hear anything more about the Kalamas in the Pali Canon. They are unknown to us, whether they continued to be confused or whether they carried on to be, continued in their Buddhist practice. But the sutta itself, it remains a kind of testament to this very experiential approach that the Buddha was well known for, that we can still appreciate. And that approach is still, I'd say, completely basic to what we mean by Buddhism today. So I better stop there. Thanks very much. Mm-hmm.